Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, April 6, 1815, six Americans are killed, dozens wounded in a chaotic attack on prisoners being held at the grim Dartmoor Prison in southwest England. These were American prisoners, prisoners of the War of 1812. And here we are, after the war has died down, British troops opening fire on Americans held captive in a British prison. The Dartmoor Massacre is an event that's largely been forgotten, in part because it was overshadowed by other events around the War of 1812, but also in part because, as we'll discuss, the incident was papered over by both British and American governments. But it's a really fascinating story. It gets at lots of questions of war and citizenship, but also, to my mind, what it means to be protected or abandoned by one's government. So here to discuss the Dartmoor Massacre is Nick Guyatt, professor of North American history at the University of Cambridge and the author of a new book about Dartmoor Prison and the Dartmoor Massacre. It's called The Hated Cage. It is coming out now. Nick, thank you for doing this.
Jody, thanks for having me on.
And with us, of course, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hello, Jody.
Hey there.
So, Nick, before we get to the incident itself, who's at Dartmoor? How big is it? What types of prisoners are there? Just describe the facility.
I mean, Dartmoor is a bonkers place. So, like, it's a prison of war camp, or at least it's supposed to be a prison of war camp, but it's made of granite, and it's in the middle of nowhere. So, actually, we don't have long. So, I'm not going to get into the mad story of how Dartmoor gets built in 1809, but basically, Britain needs a place to put prisoners from its wars with France, with Napoleon. It builds this gigantic prison, partly through a bunch of grift involving the British royal family. Maybe that won't surprise people. And then a bunch of French people end up there, first of all. And then from 1813, a bunch of Americans captured during the War of 1812 with Britain. So you have these kind of two wars going on at once, the war that Britain's waging with France and the one with the US. And the prison just fills up initially with French people, then with French and Americans. And then eventually in 1814, when the war with France ends, it becomes an American prison, and the guys who are there are mostly sailors. So these are folks captured on the seas, about 6,500 in total through the period of the War of 1812. And get this, 1,000 of them are black. So you actually have this fascinating circumstance where the prison ends up being racially mixed, which again is something I get into a lot in the book.
Well, and are the black prisoners treated differently from the white prisoners being held there?
Oh my God, it's a nuts story. Okay, so it is the first racially segregated prison in American history, and it's in southwestern England. But it's not the Brits who segregate the prison. Well, the Brits segregate the prison, but they do it because the white Americans asked them to. But it's a cracker story. So one of the reasons that these white Americans decide that they want to be separated from black prisoners is because in a prison, prisoners basically get a lot of latitude to basically adjudicate disputes, to find ways to try and run like prisoner justice. And the white prisoners don't want to share that power with the black prisoners. So in effect, for the white prisoners, finding themselves suddenly stuck in this space, there are no captains anymore. There's no like authoritarian officers. Instead, the ordinary sailors kind of have to make things work. And they do not want to share that power with black people. So they end up asking the Brits if they can segregate the prison. And the Brits give black prisoners their own space, their own block, and white prisoners their own block. But this is like a period before prison cells and stuff like that. So during the day, you're allowed to move from block to block. So again, it's like a cliche, but the black prison becomes the place to go. So these white people that don't want to share power with black prisoners are really happy to go around and learn how to dance or learn how to box or go into the kind of casino that gets out there or the chapel. And the black prison becomes the kind of heart of everything.
Wow.
So that's interesting because
fascinating.
It's happening before the rise of Jim Crow in the US. So it's this almost like a social experiment in which the white prisoners are creating the same systems that you'll see emerging in the U.S. some 60 years later.
You know, here's the thing about a prison, this kind of prison in particular. What makes it different from a town like Philadelphia or Boston or New York, where, again, there's a pretty big free black community, a whole bunch of different white people. There are no women. And I mean, this is something I've worked on in my previous research. I do think it's the addition of women and this kind of white anxiety about racial mixing or all this kind of protecting of women and this kind of stuff makes a massive difference. That's not a problem in Dartmoor Prison. You do have a very small number of women who are the wives of these sailors that find a way to get in somehow, but very, very small numbers. Generally speaking, it's all men. And this all-male environment creates a very, very different basis by which white guys and black people can interact. So it's a very, very weird community, in some ways representative of what's happening back in the US, but in other ways, totally exceptional and different.
These are prisoners of war. I think often when we think about prisoners of war, we sometimes say, well, this is something that a country pays attention to, get these prisoners back, both in, from a public perspective and a governmental perspective. These are, you know, this is a priority, right? You do not get that sense with this story at all. And I'm curious if you can describe a little bit about how these were in many ways forgotten people and some of those reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's kind of a terrible story in itself. So when you're trying to wage war with Britain, you're a country like the new US, you've got two ways of doing it, right? One of them is you can go off and you can get your own navy. Well, Britain has got like 150 massive ships. I'm talking about like ships with 1,000 sailors on, with like 70, 80, 120 guns. Like, they're huge. That's one way you can do it. That's really expensive. It's pretty hard for a nation like the US to do that very quickly after it becomes independent. The other way is you can privatize the war. And you do that by essentially saying to ordinary sailors and ordinary ships, hey, during the war, why don't you just go around and attack British ships? You can get a couple of guns, do all this kind of like, you know, on the cheap. Now, the advantage of that for the US is that it doesn't have responsibility for the people who are going off and doing the shooting and firing in its name. And Jefferson is the guy behind this idea of pivoting to, they're called privateers, right? These kind of like licensed pirate ships, right? Jefferson is like, well, actually, sailors are kind of scum anyway. I mean, they're kind of low lives. Very often they don't spend a lot of time in the US. You know, these are not basically kind of upstanding patriots, but they love money. So why don't we incentivize them to go off and attack a whole bunch of British ships? Well, of course, there are some sailors who are not all that connected to the US. There are others who are deeply patriotic and connected to it. All these guys basically get thrown into the fight. So of those 6,500 Americans that wind up there, probably about 70 to 80% of those are folks who are on these privateers, so on these merchant vessels that are just basically kind of dragooned into fighting the war. Only about 10% are from the US Navy, which is pretty tiny. And again, those US Navy personnel, they're like first in the queue for a prisoner exchange or release. Right. All of these other folks, these privateers, these regular sailors, they're at the back of the queue, which explains why in April of 1815, 2 months after the war has ended, there are still 5,000 Americans stuck in this bloody British prison, right? The war's over and they can't leave. And that's how you start getting to the conditions and the frustration and the tension that leads to the Dartmoor Massacre on April the 6th, 1815.
So did they feel abandoned by the United States?
Oh, it's worse than that. They had this guy. And so there's basically one diplomat left in Britain, right? And again, the other part of the story is so the early US state doesn't actually want to spend the money building a navy. So it doesn't want to spend the money doing this stuff like properly. You know, it wants to do it on the cheap. But also diplomatically, and I don't know if you guys have talked about this before, but the early US like diplomatic service is a complete nightmare. So rather than having like professional diplomats, you know, guys you could really trust in a pinch if you were like stuck in a difficult situation in a foreign country, it's basically like merchants. These guys are spending like 50% of their time making money by trading with and being friendly with the Brits. And the single guy left behind during the War of 1812 representing the whole United States is a guy called Reuben Beasley. He's basically a merchant from Virginia. And he loves the Brits so much commercially that he actually doesn't want to really give the British a very hard time about all the stuff that they're doing. So basically the prisoners hate him. They call him Mr. Beastly. They call him worse than that, but Mr. Beastly is one of the things they call him. So these guys are kind of forced to write to this single guy in London, basically doesn't want to upset and kind of rot the boat too much because his own commercial interests mean he has to stand with Britain. So they don't just feel abandoned. They kind of feel like the US government's out to get them, which in a way it was, because circumstantially, if you're one of these sailors, you really didn't matter all that much to the American government, which is, again, very different, like you said, Jody, from the way it is today, where we'd see service personnel as being like right up there as folks who would be the people that you want to treat the best, right? Back then, less so.
Because they're basically mercenaries or these hired hands that don't have a lot of social standing or influence at all. This is a job for them too. But I mean, that makes sense of a lot of the abandonment because, you know, we don't care for those that don't have the influence or the power to sort of fight back or hold people accountable.
That's exactly the right word, Kelly, like this mercenary side of things. So that's how they're seen. by people like Jefferson and by Madison. But of course, these are just like regular folks. And again, in the early US, the kind of carrying trade, you know, commerce, maritime stuff, whether you're working on the docks or whether you're on the ships, this is like a massive, massive industry for poorer folks to come into, and also for African-Americans and Native Americans. Yeah, so actually, right. When I talk about 1,000 Black people who were at Donwell, some of those could well have been Native American, or they were Black Native Americans. So people like Paul Cuffee, kind of quite a famous sailor in this period, wasn't at Donwell, but there are a lot of folks like him who are part of this industry. So again, it's no coincidence that there's this big kind of Black population there, but it's kind of either taken for granted, or like you said, it's seen as being sort of mercenary. So although many of these guys felt passionately American, they weren't treated with that kind of kindness and decency and respect by their government. And they ended up in this really, really tough spot. Mm.
But certainly also then seeds there that we see throughout history of, you know, people feeling like fighting for this country being one of the places where there's actual economic opportunity. But then immediately after the fight is over, being abandoned or coming back home and facing all the same issues that they were facing when they decided to, you know.
Well, yeah, or during the fight here, yeah, right? I mean, right. Even after the fight, it's like these guys during the fight are basically feeling kind of abandoned. So, yeah. I mean, partly it's about the state too, right? I mean, again, you guys do talk about this, but I mean, the early U.S. state is not the 20th century U.S. state. I mean, you know, the state becomes a very different thing in the 20th century in terms of its power, in terms of its reach. In some ways, fighting for the United States in the early 19th century, the US government can say, hey, we're really sorry, but we don't have a lot of capacity to be able to help you out. And that's partly true, but you can compare the treatment the folks from the US Navy who wound up in Donwell Prison got. They tended to be much better looked after, particularly when it came to expediting their release to all these other guys who, like I said, were kind of left to rot and were there after the war ended, which wound up in a massacre.
Okay, so let's turn to this incident early April. I suppose one of the, as you know, as you've been describing, horrid conditions, bubbling tensions, it seems like one of the precipitating incidents is, you know, rumors are maybe a discovery of an attempted jailbreak. But what's the cascade of events around April 4th, 5th, 6th?
Yeah, so one of the things that makes this massacre happen is the weather turns good. Now, those of you who know Britain will know, like, the weather. So, like, in some
very
ways,
small window.
Well, precisely, right? So, usually, when good weather happens in Britain, something else bad is going on, and that was definitely true on April 6th. So, it's sunny. All these guys are waiting to be released. They have no idea when their release is going to be arranged. The guy I mentioned, Mr. Beasley, Reuben Beasley, this guy who's the U.S. kind of consul, basically during the War of 1812. He's supposed to be organizing all the ships. They're going to take these guys back to the United States, but the war is about to start again with Napoleon. That's a whole other story, right? But the fact that Napoleon has escaped from his Mediterranean island of Elba, where he was locked up the previous fall, now it's gathering this kind of new French army. Britain is going nuts because of that. They're hiring all of the ships to kind of move British troops across to Europe. So there are basically no ships around. So this guy, this US guy in London, completely failing to arrange any ships to take Americans back from Dartmoor to the US, doesn't want to let them out of prison. Again, partly because he's like, well, they're low lives. Maybe some of them won't get back to the US, or they'll go off to France, or, you know, we should keep them in the prison. It's good for them. So on this day, April 6th, nice and sunny and warm, people are incredibly bored and also kind of stressed out. They're playing baseball. We should just like move through that, like whether or not baseball existed in 1815. Just take my word. Playing baseball, okay? The ball sails over one of the inner walls of the prison. They ask the troops who are guarding the prison if they'll give the ball back. The troops are like, no. Troops did sometimes give the ball back, but they didn't on this day. So there's a little, in the internal wall, there's a little bit that's a bit loose, a little bit of dirt and brick. And so basically the prisoners, the Americans, start to kind of use their hands to crawl away at this wall and sort of, you know, start scraping at it. Then they manage to find a crowbar and start yanking at it. And after a while, they've got this quite big hole in the internal prison wall. And the British troops go completely nuts. They believe the Americans are trying to break out, which they're probably not. To cut a long story short, there's a big altercation between the prisoners and the guards start shooting. And they don't just start shooting, like they shoot. They basically chase the prisoners through the prison. They're like a kind of death squad. And they murder 9 of them. So 9 Americans end up being killed in the most gruesome ways imaginable. About 3 dozen end up being really seriously injured. Obviously, the prisoners in a state of complete shock. And every single prisoner thinks that every American from now on is going to remember April 6, 1815. In fact, one of them says it's going to be like the Boston Massacre, you know, just before the American Revolution. Every kid is going to be taught about the Dartmoor Massacre. And instead, it just disappears.
Wow. I don't know that we have the language for war crimes at this moment, but you read about this massacre, and that's exactly what it is. It's people who have no means of escape, who are looking for shelter, who are helping the wounded, and they're also being shot at and bayoneted and injured in this attack. And it's so surprising that it just goes away, because that is the kind of crime, as you were saying, with the Boston Massacre, which obviously had a lower death toll, that becomes part of a nation's founding mythos. And here it doesn't. Do you have a sense of why it doesn't?
Well, I don't want to sound like a cynic. But I think
you study American history, so
yeah, overdetermined.
That's a start,
guys. You said that, I didn't say that. Listen, you know, like the way we remember is all about the politics of the moment, right? So again, think about this for a second. In 1815, Britain is at war with the United States briefly, and also with France. It's been at war with France for like centuries. It's been at war with the United States on and off. Well, since like the 1760s, even before there was a United States, right? If you'd said to someone in Britain in 1815, this is the last time you will ever go to war with France, or this is the last time you will ever go to war with the United States, no one would have believed you, right? Yeah. And yet that's what happened. So this is actually a moment of history where there's a fundamental pivot away from two specific enmities, Britain and France, and Britain and the United States, and the future is going to look very different. So our sailors don't know this, obviously. Even our politicians don't really know this, but James Madison, who's president at that moment, is absolutely convinced that now that the War of 1812 is over, it's a massive inconvenience that this whole massacre thing has gone on. The Brits mostly agree. So they're like, let's just agree that this was super unfortunate. You know, the Prince of Wales offers compensation. Madison says no, but the whole thing gets swept under the carpet. And no one wants to remember it, except in those very rare moments in the 19th century where there's a bit of tension again between Britain and the United States. It's like in the 1840s, when there's a bit of tension over Oregon and Texas, suddenly all these like Dartmoor prisoners are unearthed. They're brought out of the cupboard and told to like produce their memoirs because now we're hating Britain again. But with the exception of those moments, nobody cares. So again, these prisoners who imagine that the abstract injustice, the kind of outrageousness of what had happened to them would constitute the grounds for remembering, it's really sad, but those guys didn't understand how history works. Like, that's not why we remember, right? Yeah. We remember because the politics of the moment allow us to remember, and they never did for these guys. And so they just dropped off the map.
It's just so unfortunate because, you know, we did an episode not that long ago on Attica, the prison uprising in Attica, and how the same sort of forgetting happens there as well. Or not just forgetting, but like how certain things get remembered is also gets heavily politicized. Who becomes the victim? Who becomes the hero? Who becomes, you know, all of these different things. And when you're at the bottom, when you're a prisoner, when you're poor, or when you're Black, those are the easiest ways to get erased within the public record. And I think this is like the perfect example of understanding how that happens.
No, totally. And I mean, in terms of the Black story in particular, I mean, one of the things that happens after 1815, especially as you get into the 20s and the 30s, those Dartmoor survivors who were Black look for ways to use their experience at Dartmoor to ground their claims for civil rights back in the United States, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, again, because the whole episode has been kind of memory-holed, like it's very hard for them to find a way to get traction for this story that they bled in the cause of the United States, they gave everything or whatever else. And you know, it was often said about the Black prison that the folks who were in this particular prison block were actually less interested in protesting against the British than the white Americans in the other blocks. Well, that may well have been true. And actually, it would have been smart. I mean, it's pretty clear from the records we have that when Black prisoners did protest, they were actually much more heavily discriminated against and more harshly treated by the British. But again, that idea that somehow they were sort of less eager and vociferous in their protest, that also undercut these efforts later on to use this for the civil rights struggle before the Civil War. So there are really fascinating ways in which slotting this story into American history later was hard. So people just chose to forget it. So,
wow.
So as we wrap up here, we've talked about how this was memory hold, but there are a few little ways in which this is remembered or Dartmoor is still in the consciousness. And it's really fascinating because it's, I think, actually not just it got forgotten, but it's been twisted in a sort of very strange way. So Dartmoor still a prison, right? And has a, or a facility, right?
I've been trying to close it since the 1950s.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I mean, in fact, it is still open and they were going to close in 2023. That's what's in my book. Yeah. And it just announced over Christmas before we went to press, oh yeah, it's going to stay open for a bit longer. So like 900 people there or thereabouts.
Yeah. And has this reputation as you know, grim and inescapable and sort of a real kind of tough place. But then there is also this thing called the Dartmoor Prison Break, which is a, and they do one of these in Tennessee in the United States too, but it's basically a race, one of these like ultra events where you're running, you're pretending you're escaping from Dartmoor Prison and you're running through the woods and you're trying to, you know, and you're over rough terrain. And, you know, I know people who run these races and they're great and they're great physical, but, you know, to couch it in the, you're escaping from this prison. Wow. I'm curious what you make of that event, and is there any historical connection, you know, when you go to this prison break race, do they tell you about what happened at Dartmoor in 1815? I mean, is there anything going on there?
Well, it's funny, right? Because Dartmoor, if you talk to most people in Britain, they know about Dartmoor. I mean, it's in like the Hound of the Baskervilles. Like, right. It's got kind of Sherlock Holmes vibe. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A bunch of IRA people were put there, like Irish Republicans were there, conscientious objectors, but always when it's been a convict prison. So actually, after the War of 1812, and after this final little bit of the war with Napoleon, it got shut down. And you remember I mentioned to you before, it doesn't have cells. So basically, there are like seven big prison blocks, but they haven't got cells. So if you're a prisoner there, like an American or a French sailor, you just have to like sling up your hammock between these two hooks, basically. So you imagine all of these people there at night in hammocks, and then in the day, just this big kind of warehouse. So all of the stories that people tell about Dartmoor are stories based on it being a convict prison, which it becomes in the 1850s, because the Australians complain about the fact that Britain keeps sending them convicts. So again, another wild global connection. The only reason it ends up being retrofitted so it gets cells after it's been disused for like nearly 40 years is because of the Australians, because Britain is still sending people off to Australia. So everybody thinks in Britain that they know a bit about Dartmoor as a place of convicts. When you tell them it was prisoners of war, or when you mention the massacre, it kind of blows their mind. So I think you're absolutely right, Jody, that it speaks to the way that we like aestheticize or fetishize prisons, right, without actually thinking about the truly grim scene that runs through almost every aspect of them across history. And this is the moment when prisons are getting started in their modern form. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fascinating to think about Dartmoor as being the sort of granddaddy of the prison complex.
I did not know about Dartmoor previous to this. And now I'm just like, oh my gosh, it's crazy.
Yeah, there are so many other elements here. And, you know, luckily there is a big new book to dive into. And so the book is actually out right now. So congratulations, Nick. And I know you are doing a bunch of events. I know on your Twitter feed, you've been pointing out some of the events you're doing in the US. So folks should, that the best way to do it? Follow you on Twitter and sort of see if you're coming to their town.
Yeah, at Nicholas Guy, I will probably be coming to your town, so look out.
Yeah, definitely. And pick up the book. It is called The Hated Cage. But Nicholas Guy, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Radiotopia. From Pete.